I'm Joe Conkright. Today on The Art Beat, we catch up with Kentucky author Crystal Wilkinson. You were here earlier in 2016 to talk about your new book, but we wanted to have you back again and talk a little bit. How has it been since the book came out? How's it being received?
It's been really amazing. You know, my agent had tried to get me with a larger press, so I always was sort of worried about that. But I really wanted to get the book out in this form and not change it a lot. So it's been pretty tremendous. The book just won the 2016 Ernest Gaines Award for Literary Excellence. So that's been great. The book and I were just named the Southern Living Magazine named 50 Southerners who are promoting change. And I made that list. And I think it was, you know, through the book and my work with the bookstore that spurred that along. So it's been a great year.
Yeah, you're so busy though. I mean, you're in Berea. I guess you're teaching classes there. You're writing, and then you've got Wild Fig here in town. So how do you find time to even write?
Oh, it's really hard. it's hard, and I kind of have to just put it on the calendar as though it's a meeting, even though it's a meeting with myself and my characters. And that's how I have to do it. Otherwise, it doesn't get done because I love writing so much that it almost feels like I am, if I allow myself, it'll feel like that I'm goofing off from my other jobs. So I have to schedule it in and get it done to be able to push it forward.
How much do you typically schedule yourself? Like what kind of
At least 3 hours. I have this wonderful habit that is horrible to some people, but when I'm writing at my best, I get up at 3, and I'll write from like 3, definitely from 3 to 6, but sometimes it'll be from 3 to 7 or however long I can keep going with it. Usually Ron has to be at the bookstore by 7:30, and right now we're down to one car, so I'll stop sometimes at 6:30, but that's my favorite time to write.
Well, there's nothing else going on at that time. The whole world is asleep, so I can see that.
Well, that's what I say. When I tell my students this, their faces drop because, you know, some of them, not all of them, but some of them are still out partying.
They're just getting in.
Yeah. And I'll say 3 a.m. is the great time. And, you know, my neighbor's not mowing his lawn. If there's dishes in the sink, they don't demand to be washed. There's nothing on television. Probably is something somewhere, but I'm not as possessed to procrastinate.
Are you up at that point or do you lay back down for a nap? I mean, how does that work?
No, I'm usually up.
Mm-hmm. Once you get up,
you're
up.
Yeah. That's how my day just starts.
I take it you go to sleep pretty early then, I guess.
I do. I'm usually asleep by 9:30, sometimes before then.
I always like to ask writers to describe their space where they write, where they feel most comfortable to compose.
I don't really have one now. I've learned a lot from Ron. Ron, my partner's a poet and a visual artist, and Ron can poet or draw anywhere. Like he can be in a corner with things piled up, and I learned from him a lot in the 10 years that we've been together because I used to be one of those kind of writers that kind of had to like move the curtain over so much so the sun can come in a particular way and everything had to be lined up. But I don't need that as much now. So I can work on my laptop with just my laptop on my lap and on the couch or in an office. I don't have a dedicated space at home to write. I like to write at the kitchen table. And I have really odd places that are strangely effective for me. Like a lot of writers go to writing retreats and things like that. It's odd to say, but it doesn't happen as much anymore since I don't have a clunker. But I used to love to write while my car was being worked on.
Interesting. And not just in the car, but like while it's being worked on.
While it's been worked on at a garage somewhere where you could smell the old oil and the tools kind of. And I think it's just everything's nostalgic for me. So I think it reminded me of my childhood because I used to go everywhere with my grandfather. And that was one of the places he went, you know, at least 2 or 3 times a week was to a garage somewhere.
Yeah. It's good to have a bank of those kind of memories, things that sort of activate the mind,
mm-hmm.
kind of take you into that creative space. So tell us a little bit about the book.
So The Birds of Opulence, it's a book about love in some strange ways, but it's mainly about several generations of women and how they have dealt with mental illness in the mountains. So it's two African-American families, mostly filled with women, and each of the families has sort of a legacy that they're trying to outrun of a mental illness. And then the daughters of these families, their lives sort of intersect along the way. And I think it's a subject that is not written about very much because as mountain people, as country people, as Appalachian people, we don't talk about, well, I don't think we as a country don't talk about mental illness enough. But if you go into the mountains, then it's even less, I think. And that's one reason why I wanted to write this novel.
Do you have a passage that you can read that is illustrative of the story?
This is from the first chapter, The Known Bird, Yolanda. Imagine a tree, a bird in the tree, the hills, the creek, a possum, the dog chasing the possum. Imagine yourself a woman who gathers stories in her apron. The sun peeked through the silver maples the day I was born. In the backfield, one of Old Man Lucian's beagles cornered a possum. The dog snarled, pulled back on her haunches, and bit the possum's neck and hindquarters. The possum, bloody and scared, caught in the first streams of daylight, played dead. On up the knob, mist burned off quickly into another hot day. Outside, my daddy, Joe Brown, tinkered underneath the hood of his pickup. Scars webbed out like a map on his hands, the longest one disappearing between his thumb and forefinger. The smell of coffee drifted from the house into the driveway. He looked back toward the porch where the kitchen was and knew my mother would be calling him to the table soon. He sped up his work, quickened his hands. Sometimes a discomfort settles in Daddy's back. He stops whatever he's doing, holds his palms to his kidneys and says, "Mercy." A look of longing slides down his face. We can see he misses Aunt Joe and Uncle Peck, who took him in as a boy when his mother died and raised him in the city. But he'd been away from them for more than 20 years by the time I was born. By then, Daddy was devoted to Mama, devoted to all of us. He had already learned how to blend into this river of crazy women.
Beautifully done. How much do you live with these characters when you're writing them? They have pieces of people that you know and have known.
What's odd, I think, about this book is, in some ways, this book has the largest thread of truth in that it is about mental illness and. There is a large thread of mental illness that runs through my family. My mother was diagnosed as being a paranoid schizophrenic when I was a child. And there's been several other, particularly the women in the family, and seems to sort of skip a generation, that have been diagnosed with, you know, various things, postpartum depression, manic depressive, all of those kinds of things. And so I wanted to write about that very taboo subject. But the characters themselves and their particular circumstances are all pure, probably some of the purest fiction I've ever written. So it's sort of odd that it gets really close to the bone and in its emotion and its psychological layer, but in its physicality and the makeup of the characters and some of the things that they do, it's pure fiction.
You say that a lot of your writing tends to be in the short story form.
Mm-hmm.
Was it more difficult to extend this into a novel, or were you ready for it?
I think I was ready for it, but this novel is not a traditional novel. It's very much told in small pieces and fragments of memory because of the mental illness theme. Things will pop up in short sections and then move on to another section. So in that ways, it's sort of reminiscent of a short story collection. But because it's all about these same primary characters, it is a novel.
Mm-hmm. Now that it's done and you can enjoy it, you can go out and talk about it, you can sell it, Are you proud of? Obviously, you're proud of it, but are you ready to move on to something else? I know sometimes I talk with writers, and they're like, "Well, that's done. I'm going to put that aside. I'm ready. I'm already on this."
Well, I think one of the things that seems to be happening is I don't want to let go of these characters in this place. I have a couple of books that are not set in Opulence's fictional town, Opulence, Kentucky. And so I've been reading a lot of books like Wendell Berry's books, for instance, and they're all set in Port Royal, his sort of fictional town. You know, William Faulkner wrote from Yamna.
Yeah.
Tapwa.
I know what you're talking about. I was actually going to bring up Faulkner, too,
yeah.
Because he's another that has written on that. Almost all of his books have yeah. little shades of mental illness.
Yeah. And Gloria Naylor was another author that used Brewster Place and some of the other towns over and over in books. So I think that Opulence will recur in my work, and we'll see these characters at different phases in their lives, and some of the characters will come to the forefront in various books. That's the vision I have for them. They won't let go.
I wanted to ask you about the bookstore as well. It's difficult in this day and age, but a labor of love, I assume.
Absolutely. We've been really blessed by the community here in Lexington and the surrounding counties. People have been really supportive. I don't think that book sales are as high as, I don't know, hot dogs. It's, you know, if somebody comes in and they buy a lot of books, then they may not do that again for several months. So it's not the most lucrative business, but it is really satisfying. And we get to be around a lot of people that we love and the kind of atmosphere that we love, and have a lot of community events. So it is definitely a labor of love. We're not going to get rich and be able to retire off of it, certainly.
I don't think anybody opens a bookstore with those intentions, but I can totally understand. For those that love the written word, how it would be a really nice job to have, especially if you like to interact with people. For the listeners that aren't familiar where their bookstore is located, maybe you can describe.
Yeah, it's Wild Fig Books and Coffee, and we're located at 726 North Limestone. It's the corner of Lime and Eddy.
And you can actually have a cup of coffee and sit down and peruse the books.
Yes,
and
you can have coffee, you can have conversation. Latte. We've mm-hmm. got a new food item, which is going like hotcakes, which is the pancake tacos that we have, and those have been selling really well.
Crystal, thank you so much for coming in and talking about the novel, and we look for you to come back in and tell us more about your characters and how they evolve.
All right. Thank you so much, Joe. It's good to be here.
The previous two books from Crystal Wilkinson, Blackberries, Blackberries, and Water Street, have just been published in trade paperback by University Press of Kentucky. I'm Joe Conkright with The Art Beat for 91.3 WUKY.